Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. I think that's really what's at stake, and we better be clear about it if we are to have a chance of prevailing in it. I'm delighted to have with us, for our first segment in this edition of Secure Freedom Radio, a man who's given a lot of thought to, in fact, has been a practitioner of the war for the free world at the highest levels of the United States government. He is Peter Wehner. He is today a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, but served in both the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. Also was a deputy director of speech writing for President George W. Bush and moved on up the tape, as they say, to head the president's Office of Strategic Initiatives, and was a deputy assistant to the president. He's written extensively since leaving office, including a book, City of Man, Religion and Politics in a New Era, and at Commentary and numerous other outlets. Delighted to have him with us. Pete, welcome. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me on. Delighted to be with you.
You've been writing with some, shall we say, critical effect about what President Obama's up to at the moment with respect to, I guess most immediately, this sort of conflict with this Islamic State group, or ISIL, as he insists on calling it. And you've described this as sort of Barack's world, and it's seemingly disconnected from reality. Talk a little bit about your thinking on that and the evidence of that disconnect.
I think Barack's world is a place that the president retreats to when the world becomes too complicated and unaccommodating to him. A place where the wish is father to the thought, and he becomes disassociated from reality. So I think this is very, very troubling for a commander-in-chief to be in this world. I think the reason that this happens is because I think that President Obama is a person who is deeply ideological and a very, very dogmatic person. So when the world doesn't conform to his worldview, I don't think he processes that very well. I don't think that he makes adjustments. I think that he just forges ahead, justifies what he's doing, and in some cases simply reinterprets reality and pretends that things are when they're not. And I think that there is a lot of evidence, really, of that, but yeah. In foreign policy.
Let me ask you about the nature of the ideology as you see it. How would you describe Barack Obama's ideological prism?
Yeah, on the foreign policy side, I would say that he is a traditional progressive, that he's somebody who's shaped by the academic milieu that he grew up in and that he spent time in, such as life in Columbia and Harvard. It's a view of the world that has several tenets. One, I don't think he's anti-American. But what I do think is that he believes America has, in many cases, been an irritant in the world, and that the exercise of American power has been harmful. And I think that he went in willfully and consciously wanting to bring America down a notch, that the decline is a choice, to quote Charles Krauthammer, that he wanted to lead from behind, which is a phrase that his advisors used in a New Yorker interview. They thought decline was both inevitable and, in some respects, that it was good. That he wanted the rest of the world to step up, that he wanted an end to Pax Americana, and he believed that if America withdrew, it would have benign effects, that in the void that would be left, other nations, other allies would step up, and there would be a kind of community of nations that would unite. I think that's the ideology that informs him, and I think that he just doesn't understand the nature of the threat that we face.
Yeah, I want to come back to that, but just for a moment, let me drill down a little bit on this ideology, because I think you're absolutely right, Pete Wehner, that he's been shaped by some of his past experiences, but I just wonder what you make of some of the other experiences or influencers that he had in his life, notably communists like Frank Marshall Davis and revolutionary terrorists like Bill Ayers and an Islamist advocate like Rashid Khalidi. And I don't know what to make of Jeremiah Wright, but do you not think that those guys imbued him with something that went beyond just sort of the traditional progressive? I honestly must tell you, based on his record, it seems to me he's been engaged in a wrecking operation in our country, domestically as well as in our foreign policy, that it doesn't do justice to describe it as kind of just traditional, if mindless, progressivism.
Yeah, I mean, I think progressivism is on the far end of liberalism. That is, I don't think he's a mainstream liberal in the sense of a Walter Mondale or somebody of that kind. I think he's probably more analogous to George McGovern. Look, I think these elements that he's come across in his life have been disturbing. I don't think they necessarily reflect exactly his views. I think that.
But did they shape him? Is really the question. Did they influence him?
Sure, I think they had influenced him. But I think there have been other influences too. I don't think he is Bill Ayers at heart and core. Who I think Bill Ayers is anti-American in very deep and real ways. The fact that Obama would have associations with him is disturbing, but I do think that there's a distinction between them.
Let's just leave it at that for the moment, because I do want to talk about the Islamists and the mischaracterization. I mean, it seems it can't any longer be ascribed to just a cluelessness. It seems to me what we're seeing, Pete Wehner, is a very sympathetic president to the Islamist agenda, making excuses or downright misrepresenting the nature of the enemy we're up against. Talk a little bit about how you would characterize, for example, his insistence that the Islamic State has nothing to do with Islam and religion of peace and all of that.
Yeah, well, I think this is evidence of his detachment from reality. I think that he doesn't want to accept that. I just think that it's too jarring. It causes a cognitive dissonance because the world that he grew up in from his approach to things, he just isn't willing to accept that there are elements within the Islamic State that are deeply radical and militant and want to impose Sharia law, and that that's a violation and a threat to Western civilization and to the tenets and principles of it. Now, I think he probably can make an argument, a utilitarian argument, which is we don't want to turn this into a religious war, and we want to try and buttress and support some of the more moderate elements within the Islamic world. Certainly not everybody who's of the Muslim faith subscribes to this most malicious and malignant and malevolent form of it. But the reality is that an awful lot of them do. And this is a real problem that is within the Islamic world, the fact that he won't ascribe this to Islam, even though the Islamic State is the Islamic State. They themselves call themselves, refer to themselves as Islamic, is a problem. So I think that he's not willing to accept reality, and I think that is a huge problem, because you've got to be able to identify the problem before you deal with it and address it and defeat it.
Peter Wehner is our guest. He is a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center these days, and served in senior ranks of the George W. Bush administration. Pete, just in closing, on that point, one of the things that it does seem to me we're confronting as the president now ratchets up military operations against this Islamic State, or ISIL, as he insists on calling it, both in Iraq and in Syria, is the distinct possibility that we will find ourselves engaging with an enemy we're not clear about in a manner that is wholly inadequate to dealing with specifically the ideological underpinnings and animating force of the threat. Could you talk just a minute or so about that?
Yeah, that really worries me. I mean, I think that he's going into this war in a half-assed fashion, if I may say so. I think that there's an element of him of checking the box. He felt like he had to do something in the wake of the beheadings but that he wants to be de minimis. He always wants to be de minimis in his exercise of military force. And sometimes that's the worst of all possible worlds. That is, it escalates a war. It gets the United States involved in a war, but he's not committed to winning it. And I think that that can turn out to be catastrophic. I think that the Islamists wanted America to get involved in this war because I think that they believe that they can outlast us and in some senses defeat us. And if they do that, that is going to be a tremendous accelerant for their movement. So I'm quite worried that the president has got us in this box.
That's really the crux of the matter. It seems to me that we will be incentivizing them to redouble their efforts to wage this jihad against us globally. Peter Winter, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid, for the moment, but I do hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Thank you for your thoughts on all of these issues, as well as your service to our country and the work you're doing currently at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Keep it up. I'll talk with you soon. Next up, we're visiting with John Herbst about Ukraine, former ambassador there. What's going on now? Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist, or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there. America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Ambassador John Herbst, a man who has served his country in the Foreign Service for some time, including as our ambassador to Ukraine and Uzbekistan. He also was involved with the surge in Afghanistan, running the State Department's Civilian Response Corps there. He is the former director of the Center for Complex Operations at National Defense University, and today the director of the Dino Patricio Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council. Mr. Ambassador, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
I'm very interested in your take on one of the countries in which you served, namely Ukraine. Could you give us sort of a quick trip report on your recent visit there with another of our friends and colleagues, former Undersecretary of State Paula Dobryansky?
Paula and Adrian Karatnitsky and I visited Kyiv this past week. I literally left there Thursday morning. We were there for several days. We met with much of the leadership, including Prime Minister Yatsenyuk, with the political leaders, Yulia Tymoshenko, Vitaly Klitschko, the mayor of Kyiv, Anatoly Ritsenko. I met with former President Kuchma, and we also met with former Deputy Prime Minister Grishenko. So we met with a large number of people, and you might say the overall picture in Kyiv is a certain amount of gloom, given the Russian invasion and the relatively weak response from the West.
And to the extent, and we will talk more about this in a moment, to the extent that there is gloom, does that seem to you to be warranted under the circumstances?
Well, Ukraine is in a very difficult position. Mr. Putin clearly has his eyes set on that country. He has established a presence of Russian troops in the east, which will guarantee his control there for some period of time. And he is looking to extend his influence further into the country.
Mr. Messer, you were talking about Putin's ambitions, and let's start with what you think they are for Ukraine, and then we'll broaden the lens a little bit beyond there, because I'm afraid they're not confined to just Ukraine. But what do you think he seeks in Ukraine at the moment?
Well, at a minimum, he has achieved his objective of destabilizing a portion of the country's east. This has been a tactic that the Kremlin has used since the end of the Soviet Union to exert influence in countries, to make sure there's a certain part of that country where there's instability. And he has achieved that right now in Ukraine. His real goal is to make sure that Ukraine's both foreign policy orientation is not directed to the West, and that its domestic political organization is friendly to his objectives.
Do you credit the claims that are being made, not just by Russians, but by some in the West as well, that actually Putin has now pulled back forces from Ukraine and that this is once again somewhat in remission, shall we say? Or is that just another tactical feint on Putin's part with an abiding ambition still going forward?
Well, technically, that's true. But, you know, if you put in several thousand troops and withdraw 1,000, you're still keeping your troops in someone else's country. And he has demonstrated throughout this crisis, which began as an internal Ukrainian crisis late in November of last year, an ability to step back one or two steps after he's jumped forward five or six and to be poised to jump forward again.
We're speaking again with Ambassador John Herbst, and you've just returned from a fact-finding mission for the Atlantic Council in Ukraine. Do you sense, among the people that you spoke with, that they anticipate Putin will settle for nothing less ultimately than actually, essentially, controlling their country, east and west as well?
I would say that his ambitions need not go that far, but he's looking to, at a minimum, have a veto power over Ukraine's foreign policy orientation. That's, I'd say, what he's really was seeking. He hasn't quite achieved that yet, but by establishing this area in the east, which is under his control, he can at least block certain things Ukraine might want to do.
And what do you make of the new leadership of Ukraine, President Poroshenko, and specifically
the negotiations in which he is engaged with the Russians and the separatists. What do you think might come of those?
Well, I dealt with Poroshenko very closely when I was in Kyiv as ambassador 10 years ago. He's a pragmatic person above all else. I think he is actually someone who'd like to move his country in the direction of democracy and market economy and some sort of alignment with Europe, if not the United States. But at the same time, he's a pragmatist. He realizes he's got Russian troops in his country. He realizes that the requests for aid he's made, especially on the military side, has not been met. So he doesn't have many cards in his hands. So he's willing to negotiate. Having said that, the international negotiations are clearly skewed against him. It's Ukraine, Russia, France, and Germany. And there's no real counterweight to Mr. Putin and his aggressive designs.
Because the French and Germans are basically aligned with the Russians, would you say?
They're not aligned with Putin. I think they understand who he is, but they'd rather not have unpleasant dealings with him and with Russia. And so they've not been as strong in their response to clear Russian aggression over the past several months. And this has felt within the negotiation process.
Let's talk a little bit about the nature of the Western response. You've had, on the one hand, the unwillingness of the United States and its allies to provide the military equipment that the Ukrainians have sought. The sanctions regime you've described is fairly weak. You also have the spectacle of the French actually arming the Russians at the moment with major warships, which could be very relevant to this kind of aggressive behavior in the Black Sea. Talk about all of that, if you would, a little bit, Ambassador John Herbst.
There are three instruments that we should be using in a systematic way to discourage Kremlin aggression. The first instrument is sanctions. And in fact, I would say that the Obama administration has done a solid job on sanctions, because they pushed pretty hard. They understand the sanctions are much better if the Europeans come along. And given general European reluctance, the Obama administration has gone slower than they might like. Having said all that, the fact that sanctions have not come on deadline as threatened has made our response weaker and encouraged Putin. For example, the G7 leaders said in early June, by the end of June, if Russia intervention in Ukraine had not ceased, there'd be sectoral sanctions. Well, that didn't happen. You didn't have those sectoral sanctions until after the Russian-led separatists shot down that airliner in the middle of July. And that was a problem. But that's sanctions. That's one. Two, on military equipment, everyone, including the American administration, has been weak. And in fact, if you look back at the history of the Cold War, you see that all security steps, major security steps, required American leadership, and that's missing on this issue. I'm not sure why the administration is neuralgic on the subject of providing military equipment to Ukraine. The argument they use that this would only escalate hostilities is preposterous. It's precisely the absence of this equipment that has encouraged Putin to escalate numerous times. Mr. Putin has a problem in that his public does not want his troops fighting their fellow Slavs in Ukraine. So he is hiding from his public the fact that they are. Casualties are therefore a very big vulnerability for Putin. So the ability for the Ukrainians to inflict casualties on Russian aggressors would help prevent additional Russian aggression in the country. We should be providing arms. Third point, NATO. NATO should understand that Mr. Putin's designs go beyond Ukraine, and that Mr. Putin's designs require a strong alliance response. The Wales summit was a joke. Yes, they talked about standing up this rapid reaction force. That's a good thing. But that frankly was on the agenda a year ago when there was no Russian aggression in Ukraine. What they needed to do in Wales, especially since Putin had sent in his troops just a few days before the Wales summit, absolutely outrageous, showing his contempt for Western leadership. What NATO should have done was said, okay, we do have a problem with Mr. Putin's ambitions. Our allies, our NATO allies in the East, in the Baltic states, Poland, Romania, and so on, are at risk. We should have substantial deployment. We could call it temporary, we could call it permanent, but a substantial deployment of tanks, planes, maybe battalions, as a sign of our commitment to our Eastern members.
Ambassador John Herbst, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but thank you very much for these exceptionally clear characterizations of the challenge that we're facing from Putin and to not just NATO, but of course to much of the region beyond. Keep up your good work at the Atlantic Council. If you would, come back to us again very soon. We look forward to a further conversation on all of this. Next up, we'll be talking with Bill Gertz. We'll get his take on what's happening inside the ring straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Eric Holder is resigning as Attorney General. Good riddance. After all, no one has done more to undermine the rule of law than the man who has supposedly been the nation's chief law enforcement officer, except that is, the man whose lawlessness Holder consistently enabled, Barack Obama. From the Fast and Furious scandal to undermining voter integrity in the name of protecting voting rights, to endorsing the illegal release of Taliban commanders, to selective enforcement of the law, the decisions and precedents of the Obama-Holder Justice Department will haunt this country for years to come. If possible, Obama may make an even worse choice than Holder with his next AG. My bet is that it will be Tom Perez, the pro-Islamist and radical Hispanic activist who is currently the Secretary of Labor. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're touring Inside the Ring with our friend Bill Gertz, the man who takes us there each week at the Washington Times, his prize-winning column of that name. He is also the senior editor with the Washington Free Beacon, one of the preeminent journalists covering the national security beat, the war for the free world, in his inimitable fashion. It's always a delight to have him with us each week. Bill, welcome back.
Hi, good to be on the program.
I'd like to start with a very important development, it seems to me, at least in theory, Bill. We've been talking about the ideology of our Islamist enemies as the sort of wellspring of global jihad for a long time, and the administration seemed determined to ignore that or to otherwise lowball it at the very least. There seems to be a very considerable shift, at least in terms of recognizing that it's a problem and that it needs to be countered. Talk a little bit about it and whether there's actual there with respect to doing something about it, starting with clarity about what the nature of the ideology we're up against is.
Well, Frank, good to be on the program. But basically, the president, when he laid out his so-called strategy for Iraq and Syria, mentioned that we need to attack the warped ideology of this group. This, to me, is a major step forward in recognizing the nature of the problem. Obviously, this has been an issue going back as early before 2001. But then recently, the Pentagon was asked, what is the center of gravity for the military action against ISIL? And he said it's their ideology and that they're going to attack the ideology. We haven't seen that element of the strategy emerge. I think they're going to try and farm it out to the Arab states, which will be a problem because many of these are sympathetic to the Islamist ideology. And they need to develop a comprehensive counter-ideology in much the same way we did during the Cold War against communism. But anyway, at least they're recognizing that. To me, that's very significant because kinetically, you cannot kill all the terrorists. They will just reemerge and regenerate. And attacking the ideology is ultimately the long-term solution to winning.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more and have argued as often as possible that we do need a similar kind of approach to that President Reagan took, which went directly at the legitimacy and the authority of Soviet communism. And he had a strategy for doing it, and we're not there yet, but I'm hopeful that this is a beginning perhaps in that direction. We'll be talking more about this, by the way, at the National Security Action Summit on Monday, the Wardman Park Hotel. Bill, I hope you'll join us there, and certainly all of you will be watching closely on the live streaming if you can't be with us in the forum itself. It will be a remarkable program. Bill, you've written about the United States trying to figure out, speaking of this jihadists who are animated by this Sharia ideology, I think is the right way to describe it, namely this the leader of the group called Khorasan Group. Talk a little bit about who these cats are and what the question is with respect to his status at the moment.
Yeah, this we learned Monday, the Pentagon announced their strikes that in addition to going after ISIL, the offshoot of al-Qaeda, they attacked a central al-Qaeda group known as Khorasan Group, which is really part of the al-Nusra Front, which is really part of the Osama bin Laden brand of al-Qaeda. And they conducted an attack, and they said that there was an imminent threat from this group to conduct some type of an attack, possibly against airliners. And the question is whether they've killed the leader of the group, Mohsin al-Fadli. And there have been Twitter intelligence reports and others that indicate he is definitely was killed in the strikes in western Syria. But the question is, will that in fact be confirmed? It hasn't been confirmed yet. It's been very interesting to note. I reported a number of months ago that because Syria was off limits to U.S. strikes, it had become an al-Qaeda safe haven. And in fact, there were intelligence reports that al-Qaeda was moving from the AFPAC region to Syria. And a certain intelligence agency of the U.S. government denied that. And I think in retrospect, they were lying to me because now they were set up. They had training camps and they were planning attacks from Syria. So at least we may have forestalled some type of an attack there.
Well, and as usual, your reporting generally is more accurate than what we're being told by the government, Bill, I'm sorry to say. Credit to you. I'm sorry to say that it's a discredit to the government. Bill, talk a little bit about what seems to be developing at the moment in terms of some military leaders' pushback against the administration with respect to its so-called strategy for dealing with this threat. What form is that taking at the moment, and how serious a problem do you think it represents for the administration?
I think it's a very serious problem, and here is the problem. The president is engaged in limited warfare. The goals are vague. Destroy and degrade ISIL. How do we know when they're destroyed? We've killed their leader? Is it we've killed a certain number of their people? How will we know they've degraded? How many pickup trucks of theirs have we blown up? So this is a problem. And we know from history that war is an extreme form of force. And basically, going back to World War II, it was one of our generals who said, look, war is killing the other guy until he stops fighting. That's really what it's about. And it doesn't look like we've approached it that way. And it's clear that people in the military are concerned about that. We saw that Dempsey told Congress If he feels they need boots on the ground, he would go back to the president. The president has been adamant, we're not going to put ground forces in there. We're going to rely on Arab forces to do that kind of, when you blow up things and take over territory, you need people to go in and hold the ground. And so that's really the issue, and there seems to be some differences, although I haven't seen any of the admirals or generals put their stars on the table over it.
Yeah, we sure haven't. One other place where they apparently have been very, very upset with the administration is its decision to prohibit the use of landmines, anti-personnel landmines. Bill, talk a little bit about how important it is to the military to have that capability, point one, and point two, whether this is a further manifestation of the administration's indifference to the best military advice.
Yes, the president has listened to his leftist anti-military, anti-war advocates and gone along with a ban on landmines. Now, there's supposed to be some waiver for Korea because that's really where it matters, on the Korean Peninsula, is where you have the forces of North Korea very close, something like 70% of all their military forces are within artillery range of the capital of South Korea, Seoul. And that demilitarized zone is where you really need landmines. And that really has a militarily significant negative impact if you were to take those landmines away. So once again, the president has again sided with his leftist advisors on this and ignored the advice of his military commander.
Well, and what's really worrying to me is, in addition to those landmines in North Korea, there are places where we do need to protect our forces to have what are not persistent, but time limited landmines as a means of providing for the safety of our troops. And I really fear that we're going to find in the aftermath of this kind of unilateral disarmament, because every bad guy on the planet continues to have landmines and will continue to use them against our forces, among other things. This is reckless in the extreme. Bill, finally, we're almost out of time, but just very quickly, tell us about the secret cyber talks the Obama administration seems to be engaged in with the People's Republic of China.
Yeah, this is a very troubling development. Last week, a delegation of Chinese cyber officials came for talks on, quote, cybersecurity with the State Department and NSC staff. And this was carried out despite China's official position that they have cut off formal talks on cyber as a result of the May 1 indictment of five Chinese military officers for hacking into American corporations and entities in the United States. And so there's concern that the Obama administration may be trying to do some type of deal with the Chinese prior to the president's meeting with the Chinese President Xi Jinping in November. So there are some concerns. But I heard a number of people express worries about these kind of secret talks with the Chinese.
Well, no good can come of it, especially if it's being conducted by the State Department and the NSC, I'm afraid. Bill, I know you're on the case. We appreciate, as always, your reporting on these very, very important issues across a broad front. Nobody does it better than you, and we're always grateful to you that you've spent the time telling us about them here each week. Keep up the good work at the Free Beacon and at the Washington Times, among other places. Bill Gertz, thanks. We'll talk next to former senior drug enforcement agent Michael Brown about threats to and across our border. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I lost my arm.
I lost my legs.
But you can't see what I lost. Over 625,000 vets are suffering from traumatic brain injury
and post-traumatic stress. They're the wounds you can't see.
But with your help, we can expose the invisible wounds of war.
And get these veterans the help they desperately need.
100% of your donation goes toward building treatment centers. Help heal the invisible wounds of war. Donate at makeitvisible.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at DailyCaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at DailyCaller.com.
Any Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Any Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Michael Brown, a man who I've come to know and admire greatly as an expert with very hard-earned experience on both sides of our border concerning its insecurity and the implications for all of us that it continues to be insecure. He is Michael Braun. He is today a managing partner at SGI. Global. It's a consulting group on matters involving security. He brings considerable expertise from his time as a senior official in the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, in which he served, among other things, as an assistant administrator and chief of operations. In the course of his time with the DEA, he was involved in running 227 domestic and 87 foreign offices. He also served as the DOD's Chief of Staff for the Interim Ministry of Interior in the Coalition Provisional Authority period in Iraq. A man of many parts and good friend and great American. Michael Braun, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Hi, Frank. How are you doing? It's great to be back.
Thank you. Listen, I want to talk about your current reading on the insecurity of our border and the extent to which it's constituting, even more than in the past, perhaps, real threats to the security of the American people. Maybe we might start by talking about reported negotiations underway at the moment between drug cartels in Mexico, and if they manage to join forces, what that could portend for both the movement of drugs into this country and perhaps other things of a very violent character as well.
Great question, Frank. Let me first say that cartels joining forces is nothing new. It's happened many times in Mexico in the past. And then they eventually break up and go their separate ways. You know, in essence, what happens when they do form, you know, these very powerful federations, you know, you'll typically see a significant spike in violence, in even further corruption, and even larger amounts of drugs and other contraband coming into the United States and arms flowing into Mexico from the United States. So it's certainly not a good picture when that happens. Things become even more complicated for law enforcement. And, you know, I've told you before, when most Americans think of organized crime in our country, they think of guys like Al Capone and traditional organized crime figures, John Gotti and others. But the reality of the situation is, you know, the Mexican drug trafficking cartels, transnational organized crime, if you will, make those guys look like Boy Scouts. Just the most sophisticated organized crime that law enforcement's ever faced anywhere in the world.
Yeah, and their presence in this country today, MS-13, somebody was telling me the other day, is in 1,200 cities around the United States. I don't know if that's right or not, but it's staggering to think of what their footprint, their network is inside the United States, to say nothing of what their capabilities are on the other side of the border.
Yeah, and that's a great point. MS-13, other Central American and Mexican gangs, street gangs, have a growing presence in our country, spreading across the country. But on top of that, though, is you need to understand, and America needs to understand, that as troublesome as those guys and gals are, it is the Mexican cartels that dominate the drug trade throughout the United States. And those gang members, for the most part, are nothing more than minions, lower-level folks that actually deal the drugs on the street.
Yeah, distribution network.
Powerful cartels is what we need to remain focused on.
The other piece of this, yeah, Michael Braun, formerly with the Drug Enforcement Agency, today a managing partner at SGI Global, is the lash-up that you've been warning of for some time between these Mexican and other cartels and the Islamists, who are now increasingly present in Mexico and other parts of Latin America. Talk a little bit about your current assessment of that danger and whether in particular, Michael, the reputed presence now in the mix of operatives of this outfit calling itself the Islamic State is further ratcheting up the possibilities of real dangers from this alliance between the Islamists and the cartels?
Well, listen, Frank, right now we've got about 51, 52 designated terrorist or foreign terrorist organizations formally designated by our State Department, by our government. Well over half are involved in one or more aspects of the global drug trade and other forms of transnational organized crime. ISIS, ISIL, the Islamic State, they're receiving enormous amounts of money from very private, powerful donors. from the theft of oil in Iraq and some other places that, you know, they've got a robust funding stream now. But as we continue to hit them and as we continue to chip away at their tactics, techniques, and procedures, suffice it to say that they, like any other terrorist organization that wants to keep its movement alive, you know, they're going to have to find alternate sources of funding. So it would not surprise me at all that, that, you know, they become involved in more traditional forms of organized crime as they continue to grow and continue to branch out, because they have got to, you know, they need hundreds of millions of dollars to operate effectively as a global terrorist organization. Now, if anyone thinks for a moment that ISIS, ISIL, the Islamic State, doesn't clearly understand that the southwest border, our border shared with Mexico, that they don't understand and appreciate the fact that that's the soft underbelly of America, and if they are hell-bent on entering our country and hitting us in the homeland, if anyone thinks for a moment that they're not going to exploit and leverage that border, then, you know, whomever thinks that way simply doesn't understand how the real underworld operates. And that's, you know, we've got to do more to secure that border.
Amen. One other facet of this, and I don't know if you've tracked this, Michael, I know you've been traveling recently, but one of my colleagues, Dr. Peter Pry, has raised a concern that the possibility of one of these narco-trafficking groups, the Knights Templar, with a recent, not so recent, about a year ago now, an attack that it undertook in the Mexican state of Michoacán, has perhaps made itself particularly attractive as a partner for a group like the Islamic State, should it seek to do real violence in this country by attacking our electric grid, given that the Knights Templar certainly have shown themselves knowledgeable in how to do that. Is that a particular concern, do you think, in terms of security on this side of the border, the infrastructure of this country, the critical infrastructure, the grid most especially, as a possible target set for these characters if they do team up?
Yes. But the real threat, Frank, is, look, to hit us and hit us hard, groups like the Islamic State, if things really heated up between the U.S. and Iran, what group would Iran heavily leverage to attack us on the homeland? It's going to be Hezbollah. It's going to be the IRGC Quds Force. And so how do you get those operatives into our country to hit us here in the homeland? Those groups, any Middle Eastern terrorist group, that wants to do that is not going to enter Mexico and construct their own smuggling infrastructure, because the Mexican cartels dominate that border and they simply would never allow that to happen. So how do you exploit that border? You form loose relationships with those groups, but what's even more troubling, and I've said this before, is, listen, on a 2 a.m. in the morning, on a moonless night, there's not a lot of due diligence going on the Mexican side of the border with respect to who those coyotes are moving across that border. And if you are dark-skinned, dark-haired, dark-eyed, and you've got the money to pay, you're in. You're going to be in the U.S.
Michael Brown, we have to leave it at that. We're a little over time. Thank you very much for your time and for your expertise, your past service to our country, and that you're continuing to provide. Come back to us again very soon, sir. This is grim tidings, but it's the sort of thing we need to know for situational awareness in this war for the free world. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.